I'd like now to welcome to the program Jessica Metcalf. She is a Turtle Mountain Chippewa. She's the director of Beyond Buckskin, and she will be speaking tonight at a lecture sponsored by the School for Advanced Research called Native American Fashion from the 1940s to the Present and into the Future at the New Mexico History Museum Auditorium. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having me.
So Native American fashion design, this is something that started in the 1940s? I mean, what are we even talking about? Give people a kind of picture of what that whole category embraces.
That's a really good question. You always kind of come up against that, where do you begin? Where do we start? And so I wanted to start in the 1940s because that's where I see this idea of a contemporary Native American fashion movement beginning, and it's beginning with this guy named Lloyd Kivenew, and he's a Cherokee man who was an artist and a fashion designer, a very successful one in the 1940s and 50s in Scottsdale, Arizona. He actually helped build Scottsdale as an important arts mecca. He would later go on to come over here to Santa Fe and help co-found the Institute of American Indian Arts. And that's how a lot of people know him. So I'm going to be talking about before that, what he was doing before then, and the accomplishments that he did and how he is inspiring me right now in what I'm doing with Beyond Buckskin.
So what is Beyond Buckskin?
Beyond Buckskin started in 2009, the website started in 2009, as a site dedicated to getting my own research out there to a broader audience. I was in graduate school, I was writing my doctoral dissertation on Native designers of high fashion, and when you're in academia, you don't really have an outlet to get what you're finding out there to a broader audience.
And that is so true.
Yeah.
we're trying to remedy that here on the radio, but yeah.
And that's great. You know, we live in a very fun time where we have these tools. You know, we have radio, we have video, we have the internet, we have blogs. So I started a blog, and that's because of I was talking to these designers, and they were giving me personal experiences, they were giving me images from their past fashion shows, and there was kind of this unwritten contract or unsaid contract that I was going to do something with it, that I was going to tell other people about what these guys were doing. And so I created the blog space, and it grew steadily over time, and last year in May, so less than a year ago, I launched the Beyond Buckskin Boutique, which is an offshoot of the blog. And this is a space where people can come from all backgrounds and buy Native-made fashion, because that was one of the questions that I was getting through the blog. You know, okay, you know, where can I get this stuff? You're saying that we should be supporting these artists, but how do we support them? What do we do? So that's when I launched the boutique space, and it's been growing. People have been responding positively to it.
Now, Native American fashion, to what extent is it rooted in really traditional dress, which I kind of in my mind imagine to be very practical?
And this is one of the fun things about the title, Beyond Buckskin, because we're looking at that idea of what is expected of Native made clothing, buckskin, feathers,
yeah, exactly.
Fringe, turquoise. And then I like the idea of creating a space where designers can be creative and they can go beyond that. They can go beyond the expected and show us something new and exciting. The designers who I work with and the designers who I like to spotlight are ones who are members of a Native American community. They're recognized by their communities as members. They're also active participants in their communities. So they do have that connection to quote-unquote tradition, whatever that might look like. And they take what they know of their lineage, their heritage, and then they make it something that is relevant today, something that we can wear today, something that we can participate in and celebrate today.
I was reading on one of, I think it was on your blog where somebody was saying that they are continually asked, how do you keep your traditions and survive in the modern world? And that person said, give me a break. We've been doing this for hundreds of years.
Yes, creativity is our tradition. And I think people don't recognize that right away, but we've always incorporated the quote-unquote global with the local. We've always taken foreign items and brought them into our cultures. If you look here in the desert Southwest, your shells from the ocean are important to the jewelry. Well, we don't have shells in the desert. It's something that was traded in and then became an important element. It took on a new meaning. So we're looking at those same ideas, but in a contemporary context.
When I think about high fashion, I think about putting stuff on my body that's really uncomfortable. Does comfort play a role in the way you think about, or discomfort or whatever, in the way you think about fashion?
That's hilarious. What I love about what I do with Native American fashion is that all of the designers are doing different things. So some of them are doing the uncomfortable items that are more about creating a statement like, this is wearable art. Others are doing what I call streetwear, which are like the casual stuff, the t-shirts or the hoodies or the ready-to-wear dresses or scarves or jewelry like that. So I work with artists from, all that do all kinds of things all across the board. So, some of them are uncomfortable, but it's the performative of it, aspect of it.
Right.
But another great thing about high fashion is that when you're working with a designer or artist, they will work with you to tailor to your body to make it comfortable.
Well, that's the other thing about high fashion. You think of these very, very, very thin women who are very young and 6 feet tall and 102 pounds, whatever, walking across a runway, and that's not almost anybody.
Oh, I know. The standard of beauty is something that we need to critique. Because not everybody looks like that. I grew up reading fashion magazines that put out this image of beauty that didn't fit what I look like. It wasn't me. And I think that through Beyond Buckskin, we can create an additional space that looks at different concepts of beauty, looks at different shapes and sizes, and celebrates that. We all don't fit into one mold, and that's a good thing. We should celebrate diversity.
We're talking to Jessica Metcalf, who's going to be speaking tonight in a lecture called Native American Fashion from the 1940s to the Present and into the Future. Now, there's a whole world of Native American fashion shows going on.
Ah, yes. Everybody loves a good fashion show. Everybody. And this is something that I found when I meet people and they ask what I do and I tell them that I work in this field of Native fashion, and at first they don't have anything to say, and then what they realize is that we all engage in fashion every day. We all engage in the act of decorating the body, whatever that means, and we do it on a daily basis. So that's what makes fashion such an exciting medium, is because it can be this meeting ground, this place where we can come together and accept our differences and appreciate our differences. For the fashion shows, there are so many Native American designers out there. I'm still learning about more. And they love participating in these fashion events because it's a way for them to get their work out there. You have to have a fashion show because this stuff is meant to be worn. You can't just hang it on a mannequin. You know, it is something that is meant to move with the body. And that's what I love about these designers, too, is that they can think three-dimensionally, but also in terms of movement and performance of what is this going to look like when somebody's walking? Is it going to do a little bit of a flow? Is it going to be more structured? And even for the streetwear artists, they're thinking about when you're walking around and you have something on your T-shirt, something, a statement like Native Americans discovered Columbus. That is one of the t-shirt designers that we have on the site right now.
Nice.
Wherever you walk, people are going to see that, and you're going to have an experience off of that. So it is a way of getting your perspective out there, and it could be a completely different perspective. You know, no, Columbus did not discover America. We discovered him.
Right.
So I, you know, just always am excited by this field. I started researching Native American fashion back in 2005. So it's been, I guess, 8 years, and I'm still learning more, and it's never boring.
Are you a designer yourself at all?
No. I, in college, I couldn't afford dresses. So I would like piece together, you know, go buy fabric and piece together a dress. And, you know, through that, I realized how difficult it is to construct garments. So I do not design myself, but I used to be an artist in high school and college, and I quickly realized that I couldn't afford to be an artist. It's really expensive to be an artist, and there's not a lot of pay that goes into it. So, but I love the idea of creativity. I love thinking outside of the box. And so through Beyond Buckskin, I get to work with artists every day. I work with over 30 artists. I think there's 32 artists on the site right now. We'll be adding more to the boutique site in the coming month. And so I get to work with them, and I love it because they're each doing something different. And my you know, purpose is to help them take their businesses to the next level, whatever that means. So we have both established artists and emerging artists as well.
There are some Native American fashion designers who are becoming very prominent. Tell us about Patricia Michaels.
Oh, Patricia, how exciting. I, you know, have known about her work for a while now. She started, you know, in the 90s, and she's been at it for a while. And to see her, you know, finally get that recognition is just so almost like a relief. It's just so nice because it's such a hard field to break into for anybody, regardless of your background. And Native people were the minority of the minorities of the minorities. And so to see somebody who is a Native American fashion designer on Project Runway is just such an exciting thing. We get a ton of fan mail through Beyond Buckskin. I think they think that Patricia's on, you know, the receiving end of the emails, who, and people are just saying that they're just so happy to see us represented on mainstream television. So it's very exciting.
Just for those listeners who have never seen Project Runway, what is it?
Oh my goodness, it's a crazy show where they bring, I think it's like 16 designers, established emerging designers onto the show. It's a reality television show, and every couple days they have to you know, participate in these challenges, these really wacky challenges, you know, create a dress out of duct tape. You know, so they're forced to really show their creativity as fashion designers, and Patricia's doing really well. She's landed in the top three a couple times, and she's made it through. I think we're into the second month now of the show, so she's doing well.
They do like elimination rounds kind of thing?
Yeah, every week they cut somebody from the show, and so stressful. I get stressed out. Please now, don't get cut.
Right.
And another thing that I like about Patricia is that she's not self-stereotyping. And this is something that I get stressed about because we are underrepresented in so many fields that sometimes it's kind of pushed upon us gently that we fill that stereotype of Native people. And she's not doing that at all.
Yeah.
Her stuff is concept-based work. So she will create a dress out of white, you know, leather, but it won't look like a, you know, a buckskin dress or something like that. It'll look very modern and very contemporary. She also did a dress that incorporated fringe, but again, it's not in a stereotypical, you know, Native American fringe kind of way. It was very, very modern and very fun. So that's what I really appreciate about her as a designer, is that she is really going past all that. And so again, like really representing what this idea of going beyond buckskin, of going beyond the stereotypes.
And I imagine that if you have a market out there of people who are going to actually buy these dresses and shirts and pants and whatever, you want them to be in a contemporary style that looks good on you. I mean, most of us aren't going to want to wear an old-fashioned buckskin dress, much as we might admire it if it were in a museum.
Right. In Santa Fe, you could get away with wearing a buckskin dress right. around the plaza. But in other locations, you would really stand out. And some people like to stand out, but it can get kind of exhausting to have people approach you. So you want to be able to wear this stuff in a contemporary space. And that's what these designers do. Because we don't want this stuff to be just stuff that hangs in your closet and doesn't get worn. So this is stuff that you can wear every day. And since I launched the boutique, I've made a conscious effort to wear something made by a Native American artist every day. And I can do that now. I have access to do that, to be able to go and buy a pair of earrings or a t-shirt or a shirt or a scarf and or shoe, you know, moccasins. And you can do that now, which we live in a very, very exciting time. This is the first time in probably 100 years where Native American made clothing is this accessible, that we can wear it on a daily basis.
Jessica Metcalf is director of Beyond Buckskin, which is at beyondbuckskin.com. And she will be speaking tonight in a lecture called Native American Fashion from the 1940s to the Present and into the Future. It's at the New Mexico History Museum Auditorium. And ladies and gentlemen, if you go tonight, be sure to use the Washington Avenue entrance, which is across the street from the Santa Fe Public Library and the Inn of the Anasazi. It's at 6:30, and for more information, you can go to the School for Advanced Research website, which is sarweb.org. Jessica, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Today, I'm going to replay an interview that we did last fall with Emily Rapp. She is author of the book The Still Point of the Turning World, and she will be at Collected Works Bookstore on Tuesday of next week, the 26th of March, at 6 in the evening. She was not available to come back, so we thought we would let people hear this conversation again.
Welcome, Emily.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So this is a wonderful book that you wrote because your son has this disease, Tay-Sachs disease. First of all, what is this illness?
Tay-Sachs disease is caused by a missing enzyme. And what happens then is that the brain is not able to process the appropriate lipids. And essentially, the brain shuts down slowly. So it's often been described as Alzheimer's for babies, is one way that people talk about it. So the children slowly lose all their functionality and at some point are unable to eat. And then decisions have to be made in terms of whether or not to extend life with medical intervention. So 2.5 to 3 to 4 years is the lifespan for most kids with Tay-Sachs without intervention.
And this is something that, as you write about in your memoir, is so horrible and harrowing a diagnosis to get that it's very, very hard for people to live with. And there's this whole question of, I mean, it's almost harder for the parents than for the child, him or herself.
Yeah, I think that's very true. I think it's obviously a parent's worst nightmare. And it's also a sort of uniquely hideous disease in the sense that your child develops to a particular point and then regresses. So it's like, what's going to come next every day? I think what's great about the organization, National Tay-Sachs and Allied Diseases, the organization that supports these families, is that right away when you join, they hook you up with parents who've been through this kind of experience. The first day I joined, I got about 55 phone calls from women all over the country who just lent their support. And, you know, through this experience of parenting Ronan, it's clarified some of my ideas about what human life is about. It's very epic. And he's great company, and it is what it is, that kind of thing. It's been an incredibly difficult learning experience. I can't say that I would want to do it if I were given the choice again, but I don't regret it.
One of the things that is so interesting about the book is that you talk about, here you were, a young mother, married, great job, great friends, health, beauty. I mean, it's just a lovely life. And this child comes into your life and you'd been reading 173 parenting manuals, as everybody in this generation seems to do, and had all these ideas about the future. And then, what was it, 9 months into his life, you got this diagnosis and realized that there is no future, and that changes everything about how you see parenting.
It changes everything. It changed not only the way that I see parenting, but the way that I see the world. So early on, I decided that the only way to sort of handle Ronan's diagnosis, which was obviously the worst thing that's ever happened to me, was to sort of make my world really big by reading, by going out. And so for the first sort of 5 months of his diagnosis, I was sort of careening around town in my big fugue of grief, sort of bursting into tears in public places. And interestingly enough, many of the people who've helped me organize this, who've become really close friends of mine, are people I met in the wake of his diagnosis, people who really sort of reached out to me as friends. And so I'm really thankful to Santa Fe for that. I don't know if I would have this kind of community if this hadn't happened. I don't know. I didn't know that many people when he was diagnosed. And now I feel like I know amazing people who've totally ushered me through this experience. So yeah, it's parenting is in this modern world is like the Olympics, you know. It's like whose kid is smarter and which preschool, and oh my gosh, my kid's outpacing yours. And it's more about the parents than it is about the kid. I mean, people often say, oh, I really want to have a baby. And it's like, well, do you want to have a person? Because like, it's not a couch, you know. So it did make me kind of, not so much intolerant, but it made me really rethink some of the parenting messages that I'd gotten, which is sort of like, you know, make your kid the best. And, you know, all the messages that we get when we're kids. Yeah.
Well, one thing I really have noticed is it's when I was a kid and the way parents are with kids now, I mean, that's us, right?
Right, right, yeah.
Parents of today's kids. It's a very, very different set of expectations. And I find myself wondering if the total erosion of the safety net makes parents so afraid that if their kid isn't the best, that it's going to fall through the cracks altogether.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things that I learned from, I mean, certainly, yeah, when I was a kid, I used to come home from school and then leave the house. And no one asked me where I was going because people assumed I'd be fine and be on my roller skates and be all right. I think you're right. I think the safety net in this country, we don't really have much of one. And when you have a kid with a terminal illness, you realize that you just have the moment. And actually, that's true for every parent. You don't know what's going to happen to your kids when they go to a movie, when they go to high school. I mean, all of these things that have happened in our country and around the world. And actually, it's a lesson that the parents in a lot of the world know. They know that it's their children could die of violence or great poverty. And those are things that, you know, I was very aware of when Ronan was first diagnosed, that, you know, we live in this country where people just say, oh, that's against nature. That shouldn't happen to babies. It shouldn't happen to kids. But there are sick and dying kids everywhere because they're humans. And, you know, obviously human life gives rise inevitably to a precariousness. But nobody really wants to acknowledge that, right? That in death is life, in life is death, that kind of thing.
Well, and that's the thing. It's like we have, our advanced society has made so many things possible, like women tend not to die in childbirth. There are exceptions, but not the way they used to.
Yeah.
And we tend to survive childhood, which I'm quite sure I personally would not have.
Yeah, me either.
Without antibiotics and things like that. And so we kind of have an assumption that if something goes wrong, that there's something morally wrong with it or it's somebody's fault.
Yeah.
Whereas the truth is, and it's built into a lot of religious practices and cultural practices, is death is with us all the time.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's really hard, I think, for Americans to cop to or to recognize. You know, Judith Butler is a thinker I really admire, and she wrote a book called Precarious Life, which sort of explores the public mourning rituals that happened after 9/11. And how that was the first time that our country really was like kind of collectively rending their garments, and how that was so strange for us to see. Of course, in the context of like, now let's go to war. But and she was just saying that a lot of other cultures have these rituals of mourning. And I definitely felt after Ronan was diagnosed that, I mean, I let it rip around Santa Fe. I just couldn't keep it in. And the response I got was mostly compassionate, sometimes a little bit like, what's wrong with that woman? But I found that really liberating. To have witnesses, even if I didn't know who they were. And I think it's something that we're so careful in this country to sort of not show these extremities of emotion, although we feel them. And so there's this kind of repression, I think, of those rituals that is incredibly cathartic. There's a reason why they exist.
Well, there's also they're very beautiful passages. I mean, you were already a writer when you got this diagnosis, and so you, after a certain period, started writing, and the writing is very deeply felt and very beautifully crafted.
Thank you.
And there is this sense of living from day to day and being with your child, which I think a lot of parents, and indeed just a lot of people, could really learn from.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I hope that the message of the book is that none of us knows what's going to happen. Like, I could leave here and get hit by a bus. That probably won't happen.
God forbid.
No. But that could happen. And so we really only have these moments with our kids. And parents know that, I think, instinctively in some ways, because the kids grow up so fast. You know, that's the old saying. Oh, they grow up so fast, and you only have these moments with them. But that's true no matter what the age of your child might be. So, yeah, I think that is was a huge lesson for me. And believe me, I didn't want to learn it. So it was some hard going there. And it still is, obviously. It's an incredibly intensive emotional experience to be Ronan's mom.
Now, you had gone to divinity school.
I had.
By the time Ronan was born, you were no longer a believer?
No, I wasn't. I mean, I went to divinity school, and I studied mostly Christian theology. And I have to say, it really helped me write this book, because so many of those early theologians and current theologians are such deep, thoughtful people who sort of made their worlds really big. And what I always loved about theology was that it was a mix of sort of history and literature and philosophy and everything. And when I was writing this book, which I did sort of in a hypergraphic, unstoppable fugue of writing, was I just tried to read everything I had read to see if I could make some sense of this. You know, I was like reading Hegel's big book, you know, doorstop of a book. So I just thought, maybe he knows something. He made graphs. Like, he must know.
you describe Hegel as nerdy, which I love.
He's such a nerd. And that helped me. And it's one thing that I often say to my students is that cultivating an inner life, which I had done in divinity school, but before that as like a big nerd, essentially in the library, is it really saved me. Because it gave me a pool of inner resources to go to and say, what did C.S. Lewis say about grief? Or what are these early stories in the Bible that have to do with life and death and these epic stakes in a story or whatever? So I'm so glad I went to divinity school for that reason, if maybe that's the only reason. But the sort of deep intellectual questioning was one of the things I learned in divinity school. And I was thankful for it because it gave me moments of a refuge when I was really, really struggling at the beginning, the first year of his diagnosis.
Talk more about what you read, what you went back to that was helpful, because there was a lot of reading that turned out to be really, really unhelpful as well.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I read The Magic Mountain probably like 3 times, which is one of my favorite novels, just because it's so weird and funky and smart and epic. I did read a lot of Hegel. I would read my old papers. I reread Nietzsche. I reread Carson McCullers, who's
Nietzsche
one of my...
was helpful.
Nietzsche was helpful. You know why? Because he's so sarcastic, and he's just like, whatever morality. You know, he just kind of, his writing style, I thought, is really energetic, and so it was kind of, it was like brain gymnastics as a huge form of distraction. I found this great big book about Akkadian myths that was about, you know, Gilgamesh, the early Adam, these precursor stories from the Bible that are about the biggest questions of human existence. Why do people die? Where do they go when they die? And those were the things that I was preoccupied with. So I read a lot of really weird books about the afterlife, which some of which were sort of less helpful than others. And I went back to books that I loved for the sake of language. Carson McCullers. I read so many Sylvia Plath poems. I mean, good Lord, I think I read her collected poems 50 times through, in a part because, I mean, all the writers that I picked have moments in those, in their works, where they sort of, it's like a blaze of emotion, especially like Sylvia Plath being the prime example of that, where there's so much necessity behind the work. And I was feeling that way about writing. So I wanted to read those things. And I read Frankenstein again, which is a big part of the book, sort of the creation myth revised yet again, which is what Mary Shelley was doing with that book. So yeah, I read a lot, and in bits and pieces. And I mean, I do think I read The Magic Mountain like 3 times, which is a big book. So I was busy, but it helped me. Yeah.
We're talking to Emily Rapp about her book, The Still Point of the Turning World. It is interesting because a lot of people, I think, turn to religion when times are hard and turn away from it when times are good.
Mm-hmm.
And the way a lot of people interpret that, especially people who are non-believers, are that, well, religion is just a crutch and it's just magical thinking that people need when mm-hmm. they're in a state of desperation. But the way you describe it, it's much more than that. It's actually mm-hmm. deeply addressing the fundamental questions of life.
Yeah. I mean, I think that part of the problem with the way that especially Christians are perceived in this country is that it's merged with this kind of political platform that isn't necessarily true to the principles of the Christian religion. I mean, my parents are very Christian. They're very pious. They believe in Jesus. They believe in heaven. And they're not idiots. And they're incredibly caring. And they use that as a kind of tool, not as a crutch. So I think there's a difference. Like, they're not pouring out all of their sort of emotional whatever. They're not asking religion to solve anything. And that's really what religion is meant to do. It's meant to act, people are meant to come together and act as witnesses for other people's pain. And that's the thing I think we have trouble with in this country, is that religion suddenly has become a way of fixing, quote, fixing problems, social problems, moral problems, whatever, however you define it. But one of the things I found so comforting about being in communities of grievers, or just communities of friends, and still do in this situation, is that I don't want a solution, because there isn't one. I just want a witness. I want someone to be able to witness my experience. And that's what religious communities were designed to do, not to you know, direct people like sheep down a particular path. So, yeah, I definitely think that I'm not religious myself, or I don't identify with a particular religion, but I understand why people do it. It makes a lot of sense.
And then there's the other part of it, when you talk about a lot of the things you've read, is the practice of art. And there's a great quote that you have by mm-hmm. Kurosawa, the Japanese filmmaker.
Yeah, to never avert one's eyes.
Yeah, yeah. The artist yeah. is the person who never averts
one's
eyes.
Never averts one's eyes, yes, that's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, art was very helpful. I mean, obviously, writing helped me move through this. I mean, I don't know what I would have done if I hadn't been able to write this book. I think I probably would have lost my mind, frankly. I mean, it was the thing that helped me get up in the morning, was to be able to sit with Ronan and write about him and feel like I was creating something out of the situation that seemed so medieval and abominable to me that almost, you know, still I sometimes can't believe it's happening. But I had to make something out of it. And I think that's a very artistic impulse. And it's one yeah. that, it's primal. I had a lot of friends who sort of worked their feelings about Ronan into their artwork. And that passage about the shining room, a friend of mine made an art installation of just sort of yellow paper. And you walk in and out of this room and it's like a room of wonder.
We were talking about this before we went on the air, and maybe this is something that you could read, because it speaks to this whole question of, when you have a situation like this and you're a writer, you make a narrative out of it. And we, I think, all, this is something that, I mean, September 11th just passed several days ago, and I think a lot of people, mm-hmm. the way they dealt with September 11th and the way they deal with whatever the trauma is in their life is they make it into a narrative, and then they can live with it because they have a story.
Right.
And you have done that with this book, but there's also this thing that you wrote that spoke to not having a narrative.
Yeah. I'll just read, do you want me to read that paragraph?
Yeah.
Okay. I allowed myself to imagine Ronan in a landscape of light and continuous revelation, his life lived as a series of singular moments. I wondered if in some ways the greater loss here was mine, not Ronan's. Yes, Tay-Sachs disease would take his life. The number of his days was determined long before he could make a decision to transform the life he'd been given in one direction or another. He was denied that, but I couldn't imagine that his world was so remote, so unknowable. In this short story of his life, I could not believe that he had been denied wonder. What if every moment of Ronan's life was, for him, like stepping free into a space, into a first, into a state of wonder. Wonder that exists outside and beyond narrative. Wonder that feels like entering again and again, for the very first time, a shining room.
We're talking to Emily Rapp. So this is a question, again, getting back to when a child that young, I mean, infant, get sick like that, and of course you give him the best care that he mm-hmm. can possibly get and make him as comfortable as he can possibly be. We can extrapolate from this book quite a lot about what your experience is like, but what is his experience like?
You know, that's a really good question, and I don't know the answer. That's one of the things that is both haunting and sort of weirdly comforting to me in some ways. Because he cannot articulate it, and his cues, his physical cues are so subtle, I don't really know what his experience is like. I mean, I definitely know when he's uncomfortable, because I've learned, myself and his father have both learned to figure out what when he needs something. But I don't know. He's a mystery to me in some sort of deep, profound way. And people have asked me, it's funny, because I have a friend who's like, he looks like he can see. And he's blind. He can't. But who knows? I mean, that's one of the things that is, who really knows? And that is a good question. I certainly don't think that the bulk of his experience is incredibly pleasant, because Tay-Sachs is a really difficult disease. But a lot of people have said to me when they're around him, they feel really peaceful, because he's only in the moment. Like, he has no past, no future, and no anxiety, because he doesn't have the sort of cognitive development to do that. And that's pretty fascinating.
And you describe moments in your own life of a kind of peace and happiness being around him, despite the fact that you're in an obviously difficult situation.
Yeah, I mean, I do feel like, I certainly feel like the grief I have about Ronan is deeper than any grief. I mean, it's the deepest feeling I've ever had of pain. It's the deepest pain feeling I've ever had, emotional pain. But with that comes, I think, a greater capacity to experience joy. So I feel like the moments of joy that I have are like off the chart, just like the moments of grief that I have are sort of like stepping into a trap door and just like falling and never really hitting the floor. So there's an extremity that comes with extreme emotion. And, you know, I'm thankful for the joy parts, because they come out of nowhere, because that helps me survive the sort of the plummet, frankly. So I think that's a lot of people who've written about grief, C.S. Lewis probably the best or the most articulately, he talks about that, just being like in a state of absolute euphoria sometimes, remembering his dead wife. And then, you know, at the end of the night, he's sort of like out in the garden scratching in the dirt, like weeping. So I think it's both of those things. And people, it's a huge polarity between those two experiences, but it's also very human. I mean, if we live long enough, we all die, but we also lose people, and they change or they leave, or, you know, there's such the precariousness to our life. And it's, when you realize that, it actually is an incredibly liberating feeling.
Yeah. And it's funny, and it's not comparable, but it's the only thing, as a kind of ridiculous animal lover, it's there's a kind of much fainter but still similarity to it, because the animals that you have in your life, they're never going to get any smarter.
Yeah, that's so true.
You know, they're never going to really change. They're completely in the moment, and you're going to lose them.
Yes, you will see that to the end of their life. That's totally true. I mean, I think, and I also think, you know, people often say to me, well, I don't know what you're going through because I've never lost a child. And I'm glad you brought that up, because I don't think, grief is not quantifiable, right? There's no hierarchy of suffering. If there was like a grief Olympics, like who would want to win that, right? I mean, but I do think people assume that like losing a child is the worst, and then, you know, losing your pet fish is like not that bad. But you don't know who's losing the pet fish. You don't know. I mean, people might get a zit and feel sad. Who knows? Like, there's no ladder of suffering. There's no one that can say, I suffer more than you. And that game is sort of it doesn't make any sense. It's not very human. It's a distancing maneuver, I think.
Well, one thing that I think is really important is that, I mean, even in this country, up until, a few generations ago, people were always losing their children.
Oh,
that was a part of life. And it's like you've got, in a way, more in common with 18th and 19th century women than with your own peers.
I always knew I was in the wrong century. No, I mean, I think, you know, I worked as a relief worker in my early 20s and was in Africa a lot and saw a lot of women lose their children, or in the grief moment after their children died of things like, you know, diarrhea. So I'd seen that. And when Ronan was diagnosed, it's really interesting that you bring that up, because we were driving back from Albuquerque, and I remember thinking, I am so glad that I saw that. I mean, at the time, I didn't know what to do with it. I was 22 and just, like, kind of freaked out and overwhelmed by the whole experience. But I was like, you know, because this, now I understand them. I wish I could go back and be like, I know you now, or something like that.
Yeah.
And I had this impulse to call, especially a former roommate of mine in Boston when I was at Harvard. She had lost her dad as a teenager. And I like got on the phone and was telling her that I understood her better. And she was just like, what? I had this impulse to sort of be like, I'm in your group now. I get it, you know?
Yeah.
And that was kind of a supportive feeling, actually. It's like you're part of a community of mourners and we're all going to be in it. So, you know, now I'm in it.
Yeah. I mean, there are Buddhist parables that speak to that. I remember hearing one about a woman who had lost her child, a very small child, and she was hysterical with grief. So the Buddha said, go get a grain of rice from a household where nobody's ever died. Mm-hmm. And she goes from door to door to door to door to door. Yeah. There wasn't one.
Yeah.
And then her mind was calm by the end.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
We're talking to Emily Rapp about her book, The Still Point of the Turning World. Now, one of the things that also is very interesting in this book is, well, first of all, as you said at the beginning, you learned more about how to care for your child from other mothers than from the healthcare system. But also within the healthcare system, the people who really got who you were and what you were going through was not the regular doctors, it was the hospice doctors.
The hospice doctors.
And nurses.
It was such a different experience to go from a traditional doctor or a neurologist. Most of the medical community is sort of intent on saving life, which makes sense. It's not that I disagree with that. But when you go into a hospice office or whatever and you talk to the nurses, you're meeting with people who see people die all the time and know that it's a process that's the end part of life. So it's linked to life, and it's a kind of unraveling is how they describe it, or an unbinding. And the energy was just so different. It was just so very calm, and nobody sort of freaked out when we were our child is, we had this baby with us, this sort of normal baby. It was 9 months old, sort of giggling. And we, terminally ill baby on the table, and no one was sort of hysterical.
Right.
And it was such a relief, because most of the time when you tell someone you have a terminally ill child, they, for good reason, just don't, are sort of stunned into silence, or they try to say something and they don't know what to say. And it's just, everyone feels awkward. But with the hospice people, it was just like, yep, what can we do to make him comfortable? Death is a part of life. And I was just like, oh, such a relief. And I was just, I burst into tears. It's the part of the book. I was just like, thank you. I'm so glad that we chose to go this route rather than grasp at his life with every medical intervention that could possibly be invented.
Why did they do those?
I think that Ronan is the only baby now who... that we're not doing a feeding tube. We've decided not to do that, his father and I. And I think we're the only family at the moment that's not doing intervention. And I think there are a lot of reasons for that. I think we're taught in this country that you must save life and prolong life, or else you failed somehow to do everything you could. People don't want to have a discussion about quality of life, because then people get upset about whether or not you're saying someone is more valuable than another person. So no one has any kind of nuanced discussions about what that might mean. And some people do it for what they say are religious reasons. So I don't judge people who do those life extending interventions, only because it's such a hideous decision, and you are charged with your child's care. And if that's what you think is best for your child, great. And National TASACS, the organization that I'm involved with, no one judges. If you don't want to use a feeding tube, then they match you up with somebody who also made that choice. If you do, then you're matched up with someone who made that choice. And nobody ever says anything like, oh, how could you do that? Or I can't believe you're not doing that. It's totally judgment-free. And I think it's pretty remarkable. It's the only parenting group I've actually ever liked being a part of, because there's no competition.
Right.
It's just about support.
Right, right.
And humans,
Now, Tay-Sachs disease is very rare, and only, 10 or 20 children a year are born with it, which means that in the whole country, there's only a few hundred parents who've ever had kids who have this disease.
Yeah, there are about 50 kids right now living with the disease, or an allied disorder, which is similar to Tay-Sachs with the same end result, but slightly different sort of permutations. Yes, it is incredibly rare. What I will say is that most of the parents that I have become close with lost their children between 10 and 15 years ago. So the network of, especially the moms, is incredibly strong, and people stay in the organization forever.
Just to provide support.
They're really passionate. A lot of them have become hospice care workers or volunteers. They help organize the conference. They run sessions at the conference for new families who are sort of in the throes of those first grief-stricken months. So yeah, I think it's a very close community. So the conferences, the family conferences, are relatively large in terms of people having gone for 20 years now or continuing to go. Last year, a woman who lost her child in 1973 was at her very first conference. And she never was really hooked up with National Tay Sachs, but she came because, you know, she still mourns her son. And she was there and lit a candle in his honor and connected with other parents. And so, you know, it's an incredibly special community.
Now, in the book, I mean, you talk about the wonderful support you get from your friends, and you do have a, I mean, there's a whole, which we can't go into now because we don't have enough time, but there's a whole contemplation about what is luck. You know, am I lucky, and what does luck even mean? And people have to read the book to get more about that. But you do have a lot of love and support in your life, but you also have people who say stupid things. And
yeah.
And this has been going on since you were kid, because you lost one, you lost a foot when you were four years old. So
yeah.
And they've been saying stupid stuff since you were 4 years old.
Yeah.
What kind of, and this is really for people who are listening, maybe here's what not to say.
I think what not to say is the thing that someone said this once to me in Trader Joe's and did not appreciate my hysterical response, which was, if I were you, I would die.
Yeah.
And I just thought, really? Is that really? Is that what I should do? I was just, that's what I asked. I was like, what? You know, she was just like, okay, I'm leaving you. I think You Can't Imagine is a really hard one for me, because it makes me feel like, I think it is, actually, and it makes sense, it's a distancing maneuver. It's saying,
somebody
like,
saying, I can't imagine
it's,
what you're
I feel
going
so
through.
Sorry for you. I'm so sorry. It, you know, pity and empathy are two different reactions. And empathy implicates the person speaking, saying like, wow, that sounds really difficult. I'm thinking about you.
Yeah.
That's actually a really witnessing kind of supportive thing to say. To say, I can't imagine, I don't know how you do it, is to put someone on a pedestal, which is to distance them, which is to say, if I'm a good enough person and I try hard enough, that won't happen to me if I'm lucky. There's no such thing as luck. There's just things that happen. So I think that was, for me, that was a huge learning curve that I, again, didn't really want to learn at all. People say, you know, I'm so blessed, I'm so lucky. I think it's great to sort of look around and be like, look at all these great things in my life, but to not attach some kind of you've earned it or not earned it, or someone has bestowed this unknowable grace on you.
Yeah.
I think it's a dangerous game, and it sort of creates this cause and effect that doesn't exist. There's a great book that I talk about in the book, Harold Kushner's, you know, classic, When Bad Things Happen to Good People. You know, things just happen to people. And it doesn't mean if you're bad or you're good, and who even knows what those distinctions mean.
Exactly.
So I do feel like just saying I couldn't do what you do does make me feel isolated. And actually, most of the time, I don't feel isolated. But people who, and like what I talk about with my friends, who just kind of show up and call and text and are just right up in my business, make me feel like I can call and swail and cry, and no one's going to try to fix it. They're just going to listen. And I think I am so grateful to my friends. Am I lucky? I don't know. I mean, yes, and also no, because I don't think luck exists.
Emily Rapp is a writer and teacher. Her new book is called The Still Point of the Turning World. For more information on Tay-Sachs disease, you can go to ntsad.org. You can also go to emilyrapp.com, and Rapp has two P's. Emily, once again, thank you so much for being with us.
I really appreciate it.
Once again, this has been a replay of an interview that we did last September. Emily's son, Ronan, passed away on February 15th of this year. She will be at Collected Works Bookstore talking about her book, The Still Point of the Turning World, on Tuesday, March 26th at 6 in the evening.